Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. We always try to make a point of being on topic, and as we speak, final results are still dribbling in, but it seems pretty clear, at least from the predictions, that Mrs. May has not got her calculations right in the UK general election, and that the Conservatives Party seems to be on track to be some way short of forming an overall majority. A good day for Labour, forecast to get around 260 seats, Conservatives around the 320 mark, and that magical 326 is the number at which a party can form the government. So we're joined by two experts to talk us through this, and I'm going to lead a conversation today with, to my left, Georgina Downer and Tom Bentley, both up from Melbourne, but seasoned UK watchers with a lot of time on the ground, and Tom is in fact from the UK. Georgina is currently an adjunct fellow at the Institute for Public Affairs, and she was previously a researcher for the US Senator Chuck Hagel, and in the UK worked for Baroness Howe in the House of Lords. She was formerly a diplomat at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade here in Australia, and she's got a lot of breadth of foreign policy experience, most recently as Director of Asia Link Diplomacy at the University of Melbourne. Tom is Principal Advisor at the RMIT University in Melbourne, and Tom moved to being a Special Advisor to David Blunkett back in the Blair government, Labour government years, and then Secretary of State Education and Employment, where he worked on issues including school curriculum reform, citizenship, social inclusion, and area-based regeneration. And between 1998 and 2006, Tom was director of Demos, a well-renowned, influential British think tank. So thank you both for making the trip up from Melbourne today. We're very grateful that you've contributing your insights and expertise on a fast-moving target. But at least the initial result now does seem clear. And maybe, Georgina, if I could come to you first. Maybe just on that initial question, if Mrs. May obviously took a gamble in doing this, how come she got it so wrong?
Well, I think her failing was to take the polls in April so seriously. She looked at them, took a calculation that it would be a landslide. On April the 26th, which was about a week after she called the election, she had a 20-point lead in the polls. So she has, well, how the mighty have fallen, really. Quite incredible. But it is amazing that she believed those polls so strongly enough that she did call this election, take a massive gamble, despite the fact that she had been up until then promising not to call an early general election. In 2015, the polls got the general election so wrong, predicting another hung parliament or Conservative losses, and the Conservatives actually came out with a 17-seat majority. So there had been talk in the UK that, well, no one's going to take the polls that seriously, but she did, and I think that really fed into her miscalculation.
Well, maybe there's a wider issue about the prospects for polling industries later. It seems to be yet another case of...
Well, look, one of the pollsters will have got it right because there was such a variety on Wednesday. There were polls that said Conservatives were leading by 1 point and at the other end of the spectrum by 12 points. So it looks like the lower end of the spectrum was right. So YouGov, which is one of the major polling companies in the UK, had a new algorithm they were using, which basically was looking at likely turnout of different parts of society, and they were putting a bigger emphasis on the young vote, and I think that's actually looks like it's turned out to be the case, that young people have turned out much more than they have in previous elections.
And maybe learning the lesson of last year's referendum.
Indeed.
I'll come back to the policy issues and implications soon, but Tom, while we're on the campaign itself, just look to you. for your thoughts on how the campaign was run. Was it a mismanaged campaign? Did that contribute to the result? And maybe particularly focus in on the role of the two attacks that took place in Manchester and in London just a few days ago. What influence, if any, did they have on the outcome?
Yeah, okay. Sure. She had a shocking campaign. It's an interesting thing, I think, that it relates to the question about the polls as well, how the conduct of the campaign and the performance of individual leaders becomes part of the narrative of the whole period, and then the way that voters choose to cast their votes. And Theresa May ended up getting kind of caught on the wrong end of a negative spiral, which said she's called this campaign for reasons of political opportunism. And in doing that, what she did was to put all of the focus onto herself. And then during the subsequent few weeks of campaigning, not just for voters and all the different kind of community groups and electorates, but of course the whole of the media industry and all of the professional analysts and commentators who all have to watch this 24 hours a day for the campaign period, questioning her assumptions and testing her gamble becomes everybody's collective focus. And in the conduct of those few weeks, she's made some huge errors. They come, I think, from trying to move too fast and trying to assert a kind of top-down authority which wasn't really there. The reality of today's Conservative Party is that they're a very diverse and unruly bunch. She's been trying to kind of herd them into a common set of positions and then win an election in order to bolster her authority, and that's unraveled. Some of the central manifesto promises and the means of communication that she's used, you know, they've taken the media, they've taken it to calling her the Maybot, just repeating these lines about strong and stable leadership, has ended up going down very badly because journalists got frustrated, members of the community got frustrated. A very simple narrative has taken root, which says she's trying to keep it all to slogans because she doesn't really know what she's doing. And then into that has intruded these terrible attacks, which have kind of created very traumatic and complicated human drama and raised the really deep and intractable issues of security, terrorism, Islamic radicalization, the role of the EU, how to coordinate different agencies. Many people assumed, perhaps her too, that the impact of pushing the focus so brutally onto security issues would be to her benefit, but it doesn't look like it's turned out that way. And I think part of the reason for that is that she's not entirely sure what to do. Most governments are not entirely sure what to do about these kinds of attacks. But it's also got wrapped up in a very interesting way with, you know, on the one hand, the idea that Corbyn and today's Labour Party are completely hopeless on security issues. But on the other hand, Theresa May spent 5 years under David Cameron cutting police numbers. Mm. And that contributes to the deeper uncertainty, which I think is at the heart of this election.
Yeah. Now, Theresa May also became Prime Minister in very unusual circumstances following the Brexit referendum. And some people have made the charge that she was not a natural public politician, and that was also a contributing factor. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think there are many stripes of politician, and they're all humans. They therefore have different strengths and different limitations in the way they communicate, the way they operate. Is she a natural politician? Well, she's been dedicated to politics. She's fascinated by politics. She's been very effective, and she positioned herself to become a leader. She actually stood out from the pack in a very impressive way, in one sense. But some of the qualities that have been revealed during this much more tumultuous period, she's rigid. She finds it difficult to compromise and to communicate and to empathize. Many of the things that are also looked for in kind of front rank politicians, she seems to struggle more with. So the interesting thing about it is that if she doubled the majority, many people will be saying, well, she's the politician's politician, or she's the politician for this era. It's all about the context, I think, very often.
Yeah. Georgina, what are your thoughts on the campaign? Would you add anything to that? And what about takes two, of course, to hold the campaign? We haven't spoken about Mr. Corbyn's leadership of the Labour campaign, but often written off as a joke figure. But did he actually turn out, did he stand up in a way that was not expected and lead a more professional campaign from the opposition?
Well, he definitely defied the extremely low expectations that people had of him. And I think that was, he started from such a low base that he could have only improved upon that. And he did. He surprised people with his the effectiveness of his campaigning. He campaigned with a lot of passion and charisma in stark juxtaposition to Theresa May, who, as Tom was saying, was very wooden, just stayed on her talking points and her sound bites, and that was it. So he was strongly backed by some activist groups. A significant one was called Momentum, which has personally backed him. They were very important in getting him across the line in the leadership ballots, so getting Labor Party members to vote for him. When most of his party room didn't vote for him, at least the activists and Labor Party members did, which got him really clearly over the line last year. He developed a manifesto which was to the hard left of the Labor Party. We were talking about this before. His leadership is like, well, from the Liberal Party's context, say Warren Entsch becoming leader of the Liberal Party. He's a renegade backbencher who's leading the party. He has the extreme views of the hard left of the party, and he put this in a manifesto, which amazingly seemed to sell, especially with young people. Yeah. Offering free tuition, offering a lot of spending promises, nationalising industries, so really going back to the 1970s in a lot of respects, and challenging the whole market economy that Tony Blair had embraced so strongly in the 90s, challenging the whole concept of private property ownership. I mean, these are totally revolutionary ideas.
Literally.
They are indeed. And it seems to have, I mean, I don't think you would say that it has mainstream appeal in Britain, but it captured the minds of the young vote. And to see those people coming out and turned out that vote, that's really tipped it in his favour, at least to reinforce his leadership position. And I think it's a question, really, where does the Labor Party, the right of the Labor Party, go now? I think they'll just have to fall into line quietly behind Jeremy Corbyn. The other side of the coin, of course, the Conservative Party. As one of the commentators in the UK said this morning, there is no way that Theresa May will be leading the next campaign, the next general election. She may last now. She may very well not, but she won't be there. She won't be their leader at the next general election. She has proved herself an ineffective campaigner.
I'd like to come back to Mrs. May's prospects and Mr. Corbyn's prospects soon, but one of the strange things looking back from this distance as a Brit on the campaign was that Brexit again obviously framed the whole rationale behind the change of government and the campaign in the first place, but yet as a campaign issue it didn't really feature centrally. Could you explain why that is, how you read the result, if we assume that it is verging towards a hung parliament, what the influence of Brexit was on voter behaviour, what a hung parliament decision actually says about Brexit, can we make those conclusions? And then moving on to that, maybe starting with you, Tom, and then we'll move to Georgina. The negotiations are on a short fuse to start in just 10 days' time. What's the implication for Brexit? Presumably it makes it much more difficult for a hard Brexit to take place now, but I'd encourage you both also to think of both sides of the coin. Given that it is a negotiation, are the Europeans likely to change their tack in the hope perhaps that this might even put off the train from coming off the tracks? Tom, start with you.
Well, there's a lot in this, and so we can, you know, we need to bring it out in discussion. There are two reasons why I didn't figure that much in the campaign. One is that Theresa May gambled her whole position on it and said, well, this is my pitch. I need a strong hand for the Brexit negotiations. But she has no clear and detailed agenda for what those negotiations should really be about, and they're still trying to get to grips with that. So she failed to offer substance or red meat in a kind of campaigning sense, because really the whole, her becoming prime minister and then forming a cabinet and developing a strategy for government is all based on trying to kind of desperately race to stay ahead of a tsunami, and it's now kind of catching up. The second quite simple political reason for that is that by not opposing the triggering of Article 50 in the UK Parliament, the Labour Party avoided the trap of appearing to oppose her Brexit plans. And so many people felt and feel deeply anguished about that in the UK, about what kind of stance, what should we be redebating, who's still in favour of a second referendum, you know, what are the issues that are potentially in play during a negotiation. But Jeremy Corbyn, partly because he doesn't care that much about the EU either, in a quite ironic twist, he's anti-European, has managed to sidestep that. And so as an issue, it just kind of fell flat. And what's emerged, I think, is that some of the deeper roots of people's willingness to vote for Brexit, the sense of alienation and distance that many working class voters, former traditional Labour voters and so on, have felt, that anger and alienation is coming up, but it's coming up now in unpredictable ways, and they're falling into unpredictable election results for the Tories as well as for Labour.
Georgina, before I come to you, I also want to, Tom, just exploit the fact that you've got Labour Party experience and ask that question about Jeremy Corbyn. To what extent, I mean, where does it come from, the anti-European feeling? Is that representative of a caucus of feeling that's still there in the Labour Party? What's the genesis of it?
I mean, it goes back a long way. It's a particular thread that you could... The most obvious association is with Tony Benn. You know, there was a strand of left socialist / social democratic thinking which said, if you sign up to the European project as it was cast in the late 60s and the mid-70s, you're signing away much of the sovereignty that a nation state needs to hang on to if it's going to create socialist policies and deliver for the working classes. And so it was a genuine ideological and policy debate, but it was pretty much settled in the mid-1980s. And Neil Kinnock and then all of his successors said, you know, we're pro-European. And actually, for the Labour Party, being part of the EU means labour rights and environmental rights and consistent rules of justice. But it also means a single market and common financial regulation or deregulation and stringent fiscal rules and all these other things, which Jeremy Corbyn objects to. So... Corbyn, until 2 years ago, was like a mutant strain in the Labour Party, a throwback, which was but somehow these genetics have been shaken up and recast, and now they're being painted on a national canvas.
Georgina, you spent a lot of time covering Brexit result, analysing it since last June. How do you see this playing out now with the unexpected result of a way for thin majority or minority-led Conservative government?
Well, I think it puts Britain in a very difficult position. I don't know whether a huge majority for Theresa May would have strengthened her negotiating position that much, but this will certainly weaken her position. I assume, and it was interesting, Nigel Farage just earlier was talking to one of the radio networks, and he was saying he thought the negotiations would be delayed. I mean, he wouldn't have inside knowledge particularly, but it's interesting that an arch Brexiteer like that thinks, well, you know, we probably need to put them off. They're due to start on the 19th of June, but probably need to put them off to recalibrate our negotiating position. Theresa May will probably have to have a cabinet reshuffle. So whether the key players will remain in their positions for the negotiations remains to be seen. I would have thought, given, and I totally agree with what Tom was saying, given that Jeremy Corbyn ran on a, well, we've all accepted Brexit is an inevitability platform, but he has a sort of softer version of Brexit. Maybe there'll be some modifying and softening of Theresa May's position, which is a hard Brexit, you know, leaving the single market, leaving the customs union, remains to be seen. But I think all in all, not a great day for Britain's negotiating position.
But still, from the sound of it, you believe that Brexit in some form will go ahead. Is there any possibility that the genie could be rebottled?
No, I think there's absolutely no possibility. The Labour Party and the Conservatives have got probably over 80% of the vote. That was a vote for a form of Brexit. The Liberal Democrats were the only party that campaigned on a strong, let's have a second referendum and really confirm whether we do want to do this or not. And by the way, we don't want to do this. Yeah. They've had a bad result. They've won a few seats up in Scotland, but they've lost some seats in England. The leader, Tim Farron, when we walked into this, still unsure whether he was going to hold his seat. And I'm sorry?
I think he got
in. He did hold it, okay. But Nick Clegg, the former leader, lost his seat tonight, Sheffield Hallam, the Labour candidate. So the only party that crafted their entire pitch around staying and nullifying the referendum result has not had a good result. So I don't think that there is any movement to not do Brexit, but it's just the character of Brexit. What will it actually turn out to be?
Tom, would you differ with any of that?
No, I think the analysis is right. I don't think the main parties are going to attempt to find a way back into the European Union. And I think fundamentally, difficult as it is, and though there were all kinds of flaws with the way that the referendum came about and the way the campaigns were run, it is extremely difficult to go back on the fundamental democratic principle that a majority voted for it. So, but just as, from my point of view, just as the vote to leave the EU was a kind of proxy for a whole series of deeper and more confused issues or more complex issues, so the substantive debate that's still to come is what kind of Brexit, what kind of relationship with the EU, what kind of country are we trying to become? And that debate is about to break out in glorious technicolour.
Yeah. That's a good segue to take the focus back to the parties and the leaders of the parties. Maybe I'll start with you, Georgina, with your thoughts for what this means for Mrs. May.
I think it's going to be very difficult for her to continue. But then I look at the alternative. It's the third Prime Minister in a year, it will have been, about a year for the UK. So do people really want that? I'm not quite sure, but her position will be very difficult to sustain. There'll be a lot of Conservative MPs who and unsuccessful candidates as well who will blame her personally for this result. Not only because of the campaign, but because of the gamble, enormous gamble. I mean, this is an election that was 3 years earlier than it needed to be. So there was a sense that this is an unnecessary election. She took a punt. She made it about her leadership and about Brexit, and those issues either didn't resonate or she came down second best. So I think very, very difficult for her. Very, very difficult for her to sustain her brand of conservatism too. Now, as much as Jeremy Corbyn painted Theresa May as quite right-wing, if you follow conservative politics, she's actually very much on the left of the party. I mean, there were the Conservatives calling her Red Theresa. She had rejected the Thatcherite small government, low taxing, style of conservatism, and has brought back in this one nation conservatism, a big government, the state is here to help your family and fix industries, pick winners. So I wonder whether there is much future for that style of conservatism. And I think the arch Brexiteers and the right of the party will be fermenting a lot of discontent at the moment and probably wanting some significant changes at the top, if not her, definitely her cabinet.
And if it were to directly go for and target Theresa May, who would be the candidates to challenge?
Very, very hard to tell. I mean, Boris Johnson had been in the mix when there was the leadership contest last year after David Cameron announced his resignation, but the reasons why he wasn't successful then are probably still sustained today. He is incredibly attractive to parts of Britain, but also incredibly unattractive to other parts. I don't know whether he would be the unifying force that they probably need. Amber Rudd was an extremely effective campaigner. She's the Home Affairs Secretary. She was an extremely effective campaigner. If she holds on to her seat, I haven't seen the latest, but she was in, I think they were going to do a recount in her seat, so she could be a possibility, although she may be considered too close to Theresa May and part of the problem. Look, it's incredibly hard to tell. I would have thought they're two front runners, but you know, would Michael Gove try and come up from the back bench and have another crack?
Or will George Osborne be rueing the fact that
I'm sure George Osborne is seriously regretting his decision to become a newspaper editor instead of sitting on the back bench waiting for Theresa May's decline.
Well, as a consolation, he will at least have plenty to write about.
Indeed.
Tom, what are your thoughts on the leaders of the parties, but also the parties structurally? I mean, what are the consequences for Labour? Presumably, Mr Corbyn is very strongly buttressed by that, to the point it would be difficult for him to be challenged. Where do you see the sort of beyond the short term effects on both the major parties?
Yeah. Absolutely. If the Conservatives, for the time that the Conservatives remain in government, they're forced to own and process their own contradictions, if you like. So that's what will happen, and the Conservative Party will therefore have to get to grips with that set of questions all over again. And I agree with Georgina about the attempt that's Theresa May has made in this election and in her pre-election positioning to say, I'm moving on from Thatcherism and we're going to articulate that there is a social good, it can be partly achieved through action by the state, and family and free market are not the only policy levers that conservatives can are allowed to focus on. What's partly happened is that in this election, I think, and I'll try and talk a bit more about Corbyn and the longer term consequences for Labour in a second. But what's partly happened is that Theresa May has gestured towards that and promised that kind of reconciliation of you can have jobs growth and economic flexibility, you can have free trade and the kind of Atlanticist identity that many Brits still want in contrast to these, crazy Eurocrats, but we will underpin your standards of living and make things work for everybody. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn has come along and said, well, if that's what you want, here's a policy manifesto that would really do it. And so that's ended up as a kind of unfavourable contrast and comparison for Theresa May. The Conservative Party has got to grapple with what levels of tax, what levels of spending, what levels of regulation it wants to put forward. It's got to grapple with the levels of immigration that would support the kind of economy that Britain has become, and what kind of effective control it can establish over those levels of immigration. It's got to find a way of reconciling the kind of competing directions of those different strands of rhetoric, and it's now got to do it with a pretty anarchic tendency of the extreme Eurosceptics and the UKIP representatives and activists who've been largely reabsorbed into the bloodstream of the Conservative Party. So genuinely, I think it would be an interesting choice for someone like George Osborne to consider trying to come back and put his arms around that and come up with a different leadership strategy. Because partly what's shifted in this election is that the political mainstream, many voters and many kind of specific groups of MPs and activists have rejected the kind of urban, modern, small L liberal metropolitanism that has dominated both the Conservative and the Labour Party for most of the last 20 years. So transpose, so that opens up all kinds of interesting questions. But the next most interesting, which maybe we'll find more time to discuss, is that I'd be surprised if Theresa May is still the Prime Minister by the end of the year. She's probably 50% chance of surviving the week, but I don't think she would survive the year. And the Conservative Party grappling with that set of contradictions, including the questions of devolution and Scottish independence, by the way, will also have to find a way of negotiating itself a majority that works with the Ulster Unionists and the very complex set of questions about borders and Brexit that come up in the context of Northern Ireland and Ireland and the rest of Europe. So that's also going to be really interesting. On the Labour side, Jeremy Corbyn's boost is very unhelpful to the prospects of working through a kind of coherent, longer-term, centre-left agenda, because what will happen is, absolutely, you're right, he's been cemented in place. The unions who backed him will feel that their strategy has been validated and that they don't need to kind of open up their thinking about policy or political strategy any further. And the activist base who backed him, Momentum, and the whole series of other what have been previously known as hard left activists, you know, non-Labour activists, will now feel that the next stage of their project can be articulated. So the first stage was to capture control of the Labour Party, which they've done pretty effectively. The test of that was whether or not they could consolidate the position. And then the next stage is whether or not they can move the Labour Party permanently to the left in the cause of moving the country further to the left. The difficulty about that is that what it does is create a further standoff between the parliamentary wing of the party, the trade unions, and that sea of activists. Now, it might well be that the space of democratic debate and policy discussion opens up and a new set of interesting areas of policy synthesis and solutions that were previously considered not even discussable in British politics may become lively and legitimate topics of focus. But what I foresee for the next couple of years is a more popular Jeremy Corbyn actually unable to make much progress in coming up with a realistic programme of government. And I don't think that's very good for the Labour Party or for British politics over time.
And briefly, I want to come to the audience very soon, but in terms of this vacant centre ground that's a most unusual state of affairs in British politics, presumably a split of the Labour Party now is much less likely to happen on the back of this result. Yeah. Are there any implications for other parties or middle parties being able to fill that vacant centre ground?
Well, it looks pretty thin. And as Georgina said, the Lib Dems have not found the keys to a breakthrough. The Greens are still on one MP, not that they're a centre ground party. And Britain is still stuck with 650 electorates and a first-past-the-post system. So the political incentives for third parties are pretty weak. But an interesting thing about it is that, as Theresa May has just shown, it's when these surprise events look least likely is that when the new formations actually tend to strike. So I'd be looking over the next couple of years for what are the centre-ground issues that are really being neglected and where a real head of steam is being built up, and are there new opportunities emerging?
Great. I'd now like to open it up to the floor. As the usual practice, could you please identify yourself, keep your question short to the point.
Thank you. John Dobies, no affiliations with anyone. As I said, Jeremy Corbyn is chronically unelectable as Prime Minister. So my perception would be that if he stayed there the next 20 years, he'd still be leading the party into a glorious second position for the indefinite future.
I'll take another couple of questions just to give our panellists a bit of time to think.
Yeah, Greg Colton from the Lowy Institute. To follow on from that, we've seen a bit of a trend across the world, actually. So Trump was deemed to be unelectable. Corbyn was deemed to be so far to the left that he wouldn't get popular votes. We've seen a rise of populist voting in Europe and France, etc., all against the run of the commentary of the establishment. Is there enough now that we can start to draw some conclusions about how populations are potentially viewing politics and the future of their countries in a way which is different from a lot of commentators in the establishment that have traditionally viewed it?
Okay, thanks. And I'll take a third.
Rob Thomas from LFG. Just a quick query. I'd like to understand, you say that Theresa May is going to be Prime Minister, but she's only going to have 318 votes, so she's obviously going to have to form a coalition with somebody. I'd like to understand who you think she's going to form the coalition with, and what is she going to have to give away to form a coalition, and is there any chance of Corbyn actually forming a coalition and actually becoming Prime Minister?
I'll give both panellists, because the questions were all generally directed, an equal chance to answer, starting with Georgina.
So the first question was about, is Jeremy Corbyn, given he's unelectable, going to keep leading the party to second place for the next 20 years? I don't think we can really answer that at this stage. Given he's gone from 20 points behind, 7 weeks ago to, just a smidgen behind today, that's an amazing turnaround. And you can put it down to Theresa May's campaigning. But even so, he's got to have captured some mainstream attention. I think it's very interesting to see the UKIP votes collapsed, as you would expect. Brexit is now the reality, so they've lost their raison d'etre. But it didn't flow to the Conservatives in the numbers that were expected. No one thought that Conservatives would inherit all of UKIP's vote because they tended to be working class people and some hard right, but some traditional Labor voters. So they flowed to the Labor Party in much greater numbers than the pollsters expected, and they these people found that agenda, Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto, attractive. So I think it's quite possible. It's quite possible that he could be successful in the future. I would like to think not, but I'll tell you why I probably don't think he will be successful with that brand of manifesto. And he may very well, if he's leader in 2022, when we have the next general election, he may have nuanced that manifesto to more of a centre ground one. There wasn't a very rigorous debate of the economics of either manifestos. He's proposing to nationalise the Royal Mail, the railways, electricity grid. Now, they're currently all privately owned. The government would have to buy those back from the private companies. That would result in the issuing of billions of pounds worth of government bonds in order to do that. So, he was proposing to get the budget back into the black in 5 years. Well, it just defies belief. So, I think with further challenge and testing, that manifesto would have been found out to be economically catastrophic.
It is very interesting, and I don't think Jeremy Corbyn quite imagined that he was trying to become electable. And maybe he's going to reassess now.
Like Donald Trump.
Exactly. But I'm sure that he's always seen it in terms of his objective being changing the debate and therefore changing the possibilities of what mainstream politics can do. So what's the implication of how far he has advanced and how it's happened in the US and various other places? There is a big and clear conclusion. Most voters want something different. And they're not getting it from what the main parties generally keep serving up. And in that context, I think that hung parliaments are actually a very coherent outcome, and you can see a consistent pattern, which was partly triggered by the impact of the global financial crisis and the failure of most mainstream political parties to come up with an entirely coherent set of responses since then. We've seen that pattern in Australia. Labour governments and coalition governments actually going through some remarkably similar patterns of saying, oh, well, if you do it with this leader, you'll get a better outcome. And actually the public returning an outcome which says, we're not entirely convinced by what you say and your programme for government, and we want to democracy to generate a set of conditions in which you need to search for a slightly different set of answers. I don't think it is a coincidence the number of nations and parliaments that have returned inconclusive outcomes in elections over the last 10 years, including in European countries like Belgium and Spain, where they've actually gone long periods without having a government formed. That links back to the specific question about Theresa May and forming a government, which I kind of alluded to but didn't explain properly. With the current seat projections, the most likely outcome is that the Conservatives will be the largest party, and perhaps within 15 or 25 seats of an overall majority in the House of Commons. If they do that, the most logical and fastest route for them to negotiate and secure a majority would be to form an agreement with the Protestant Unionist Party MPs of Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party and so on, who would be traditionally thought of as conservative-leaning, but have a different complexion and a different set of priorities from the mainstream English Conservative Party. And they have their own very complex and delicate set of considerations in Northern Ireland. But one of the most interesting and biggest ones is that leaving the EU for Northern Ireland and for the Republic of Ireland is an incredibly disruptive and destabilizing thing to do, because there is this open border, land-based border, between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, and the growth of prosperity, social cohesion and physical security over the last 10 or 15 years since the Good Friday Agreement in Ireland has partly been underpinned by the border sharing and free trade arrangements that are kind of underwritten by the European Union. So Theresa May's policy and the Conservatives' whole Brexit strategy actually drives coach and horses through that. And the Northern Irish politicians and the Northern Ireland Assembly that was created after the Good Friday Agreement, the executive is currently suspended. They don't have a power-sharing agreement because the very delicate relationships between the different parties, Catholic and Protestant, had begun to unravel. That whole ecosystem is kind of temporarily frozen, hopefully not permanently frozen. And so where the Ulster Unionists and the DUP position themselves will matter hugely and will be influenced by a whole range of different things. That would inform the way that the Ulster Unionists negotiate a potential confidence and supply arrangement with Theresa May. But that would be the most obvious way for her to form a government and secure a majority. What I imagine, to cut it short, is that will be the focus of discussions, depending on the result tonight, over the next kind of 4 to 7 days. And if that breaks down for any reason, or if some other unexpected development occurs, then Corbyn could potentially put together what might be termed a rainbow coalition. But just because it has more players involved, and also because Corbyn and his team have virtually no experience of stitching together that kind of arrangement or working out a programme of government, it would inevitably take longer.
That would be an extraordinary outcome if it were to.
Yeah, absolutely would. And that, I mean, Labour probably would need 25 or 30 more seats than it's being projected to be even within in with a shout of forming that kind of arrangement.
Georgina, back to you. Do you see any difference in that? Is there an alternative to the DUP?
No, I don't think there is. No, the Liberal Democrats won't do a deal with the Conservatives, given they're so far apart on Brexit. I just can't imagine they would.
They learn the lessons of past time.
Exactly. It's interesting to reflect on the 2015 election campaign that David Cameron fought, and that a really big pillar of his campaign was about a Labor SNP coalition and the dangers of that. And that was somewhat raised during this campaign but didn't get nearly as much traction as it did in 2015. I mean, it really killed. It killed Labor during the 2015 campaign. But yeah, this time, where it actually seems to be a possibility, although I would say a very, very unlikely possibility, that campaign didn't really get any traction.
We are still looking at a moving target in terms of results, but I saw before the event that the SNP, predictably, given how they're extremely strong showing in 2015, they could only really go downhill from there. But where do you see them factoring in the national debate, particularly the other question around Scotland's likelihood for a second referendum, the potential breakup of the union? What's the implications as you read them?
Well, I think there's been a strong rejection of a second referendum, a vote. So the SNP went into the election with, I think, 56 of the 59 seats in Scotland. They had a complete, they wiped out Labour in 2015, and they were certainly, their whole existence is about independence of Scotland. So they were campaigning. They tried not to make their campaign totally about, independence or not. But the Scottish Conservatives certainly made that the campaign issue. And Conservatives in England have done very badly, especially in London and the south of England. But the Scottish Conservatives have had a very good showing, a very, very good showing. They've done much better there than they have done really in history, I think. And there is a view that is a strong rejection of a second referendum. Polling that was done, and who believes the polls these days anyway, but polling that was done recently said that Scots were not in favour of a second referendum. So, yeah, not good news for Nicola Sturgeon, and good news for Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Scottish Conservatives.
So no reinvention of the Union Jack and...
I just don't see it. You may have a different view, Tom, but
I think in the short term that's right, but in the medium term it will come back because the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon have such a strong vested interest in making it come back. But it's all been kind of softened and made more complicated. And what's happening is that the SNP are now adapting to becoming a party of government. Mm. It's a bit like the ANC in South Africa. They just kind of come in with this absolute monolithic majority and then begin to adapt to the compromises and the complexities of what's involved. And Nicola Sturgeon is very pro-EU, and there was a majority support in Scotland for it. But there's this kind of also this weird trick of the negotiations where the EU might not allow Scotland to join the EU as an independent nation for other reasons to do with Spain and its negotiations with Catalonia and so on and so on. So it will become a much more complex game, but the issue of Scottish independence is not dead.
Okay, I'd like to take a second round of questions from the audience.
Hi, Frances Kitt, Lowy Institute. This is linked to women, in fact. We've seen the step back of Diane Abbott from the Labour front bench during this election. She came under increasing scrutiny for her fluffing of figures. Jeremy Corbyn did the same, but didn't come under the same pressure. May has done it too. So what does this election say about women in British politics?
Thank you very much. I just was curious about what the panel thought about what was the driver behind Corbyn's resurgence. Some would say it's this concern about inequality and this huge gap there is now, the more rather than the few. And if that is the case, does that spell a problem for the Conservatives because of the generational concern they have, the support for Labour and more equality?
Georgina, would you like to take up the challenge of what this means for women?
I'm surprised you say Jeremy Corbyn didn't come under attack for his fluffing. I thought he did come under quite a bit of attack for that, whether it resonated. I think in politics you do get the benefit of the doubt once and maybe even twice, but the trouble for Diane Abbott was she just consistently, every single interview seemed to be a complete disaster. She was not across her brief. The first one where she fluffed her figures on the, how much was it going to cost to have 10,000 extra policemen, and she said, oh, it's £300,000 or something. There was ridicule, but okay, she might have been able to get over that. But then that interview she did last week where she clearly didn't know the details of a major review into British, I think it was counter-terrorism policy, and she just kept saying, "Oh, it's about resilience. It's about resilience." I mean, you know, she was seeking to be the minister for Home Affairs, the Home Secretary. So to show that she was completely unacross her brief, her portfolio, was nothing to do with her being a woman. In fact, the counterpart, the Home Secretary, is a woman too. I just don't think her gender came into it. I know there's a lot of tweeting out there that it was about her race and gender, but that none of the accusations against her were about who she was. It was about her inability to prosecute a case and understand her brief and the details of her brief. So I wouldn't accept that. In terms of Corbyn's resurgence, I mean, I said this before, I think very low expectations. So anything was going to be an improvement on that. Whereas Theresa May she was starting from the pinnacle of her popularity and was untested, but there were high expectations of her. I sort of felt in, PMQs, she seemed to be Teflon Theresa. You know, no one could speak ill of her, even though there were rumblings about her her policy position. So her campaign was poor. She didn't perform well under pressure. She wasn't engaging. Corbyn was completely the opposite. And I think this for the many, not the few. His campaign slogan. She had similar language. Actually, you read their manifestos, and it's actually a little bit frightening how alike some of the language is in the manifesto. She had policies for ordinary working families. So, and she has said she wanted to be a prime minister for the many, not just the privileged few as well. She had used that in her acceptance speech when she took over the leadership from David Cameron. So, it was a nice slogan, but did that particularly resonate more because of the content of it? No, I think he just was running a much better campaign, and of course he took a punt and decided he was going for the youth vote, and the Conservatives took a punt that the young people don't come out, so we'll go for the older vote, and his punt's paid off big time. And she also took her base for granted, I think, as well, with this dementia tax issue. So this was incredibly unpopular, basically making people who were receiving care from the National Health Service in their homes would have to, they didn't have to pay up front for it, but the cost of that care would be subtracted from their estate up to £100,000 floor. And then upon their death, their house would have to be sold and their family would be left with £100,000. So it all just sort of was a very unpleasant for people and was eating away at that conservative base of the older voter. And, if you don't look after your base in politics, you will be punished. You've got to look after your base and then reach those in the swinging centre. So I think there was just some really big strategic errors like that.
Trying to be concise and maybe get some more questions in, but I think both these questions are areas where I can respectfully disagree with some of Georgina's analysis as well, although I'll share some of it. On women, I have very little sympathy with Diane Abbott's politics and approach to doing politics, so that's kind of irrelevant. And it's true that she stumbled more than once and had a specific kind of problem, but I also have no doubt that she has been subjected to much harsher and more sustained criticism and other kinds of attack, which I know feed trolling and other things which are totally beyond the bounds of acceptability. And I think that there is a deeper cultural pattern to that, and that generally we tolerate it, and the mainstream of politics tolerates it as well in a way that we shouldn't. Having worked for Julia Gillard, I know that similar patterns operate in Australian culture, and frankly, they happen everywhere. This is a live debate. Donald Trump is another symbol of it in our kind of global politics. Different people are subjected to different standards and expectations and subject to different levels of direct attack according to how they're viewed culturally. And so it's not an accident that Diane Abbott is a black woman either, and we ought to address it more openly.
Questions from the floor?
Andrew Thomas from Al Jazeera Television. Diane Abbott's increased her personal majority by 11,000, which suggests that people, certainly locally to her, didn't like the way she was treated and have voted for her as a result. But is that symbolic of this campaign as a whole? Did Labour do as well as it did because they were the underdogs, because Jeremy Corbyn and his party were given no chance, or despite that? And that then leads into, well, is this the high watermark, or just imagine how they would have done had they not had the campaign of vitriol throughout? Because that totally affects the next 5 years. If this was the high watermark, people voting for them because they were the underdogs, then we could soon be back to politics as normal. But if this is just the beginning, then it's a very, very different world.
So in response to that, but the one thing that we haven't really found time or really named, the way that I would answer your question is we're not going back to politics as normal, because there is something deeper going on. People do want something different. And while culture, class, and any number of other things are mixed up in all this, there's a kind of identity politics going on. Actually, it's the economy, it's the economic policy framework, it's ownership, it's wealth, it's access to intergenerational opportunity, which has driven Corbyn's performance. And these issues will continue to be to dominate the centre ground, at the centre of political debate, until some more convincing responses to them are found. So what has set the scene for this election result is conservative policies on public spending, on home ownership, refusal to acknowledge or address changing patterns of inequality of wealth, taxation, and the intergenerational consequences of those. Up until now, Labour in Britain failed to really spot or respond convincingly to that set of issues at the same time. And so it's an interesting kind of set of questions and point of contrast about the two manifestos. What Theresa May tried to do was to say, I feel everybody's pain and I can resolve these contradictions by being more activist, having a different kind of industrial policy and working through, you know, this social care, long-term care type of option. It really didn't work for some of the reasons that Georgina has articulated. But why would we think that, given the depth of feeling and the level of mobilisation that many British citizens are prepared to get involved in with an extremely unlikely Corbyn-like candidate, why would we think that any of those issues are likely to go away?
I honestly don't know if this is the high watermark. I really don't want to kind of guess. I don't necessarily share Tom's view that, because I think this sort of comes down to probably an ideological debate about, do you think that the sort of whole free market economy, the liberal economic agenda, is deeply flawed, and do we need to have a new system? I think the liberal economic agenda is the arguments in favour of it are still sustained, but I do think there have been some issues that haven't been addressed by governments across the Western democracies. I think that Theresa May's manifesto tried to offer a sort of state-led soft liberal market economics solution to that. Jeremy Corbyn's is turning it up on its head and rejecting the status quo and offering a completely radical revolutionary plan that if he had got a majority and was leading Britain in the next few days, would have, I think, ended Great Britain as we know it. I genuinely believe that his economic agenda would have plunged Britain into some serious economic depression. The spending that he was prepared to engage in, the high taxation. I mean, he had taxation revenue projections, that were on the basis that none of the high achievers in society left Britain. Well, that just doesn't play out. It was pie in the sky economics, and I think with the benefit of testing those theories over the next few years, this could be the high watermark, but I really don't know.
So another, I think, largely unforeseen result, certainly unforeseen out of 10 Downing Street, leading to a lot more questions ahead. But one perhaps positive note I do take from both panellists is that the question of the union itself does seem to have been at least put back in the box. And I think that's a positive we can all take from the UK general election. I just remains to thank the panellists, Tom Bentley and Georgina Downer, and yourselves for your questions and comments. Thank you all, and we look forward to seeing you back at the next event at the Lowy Institute.